Chapter 25, Homestead. Of course, if you have been paying attention, you will have realized that if the final words of the previous chapter are a relative truth, they cannot simultaneously also be an absolute one, and vice versa, as Sean discovered, when to his great surprise the darkness that had engulfed him and Shrody was broken by the light of an electric torch from above, and the worried voices of Nonno, Mammy, and Pappy. What greater homecoming can there be than the one extended to someone who has never been away, but feels he has been in his heart? And that was basically it. They pulled him out, Shrody went off in a distinctively feline style of huff, and they all returned home, with forcibly extracted promises of never again using secret tunnels to enter other people's houses and falling down other people's hidden shafts, just to give his parents a fright of their lives. Back in his own house, old habits and routine reasserted themselves in their usual stubborn fashion. Sean would sit on the top of the staircase, just to have the pleasure of watching his mother arrive home and say, "So many people in the shops today. I don't know what the world is coming to. Honestly, I don't." And he would laugh and hug her, and she would be puzzled, but of course pleased. Nobody ever mentioned her disappearing months before. It had obviously never happened. And that was all about Mammy, except for one strange incident. When, on a visit to Paris at the Louvre, a reporter took a photo of her alongside the Mona Lisa, and the newspapers could talk of nothing else for editions. Such a likeness! Was this lady a clue to the true identity of the Mona Lisa? And that saved Sean from complacency, because he remembered what Mr. Wonstone the clown had told him, that even if all other observations seem to point in one direction, the existence of a single fact that does not fit justifies, and will always justify in a world of free will, the complete reinvention of reality. And Sean thought the clown would agree if he said that humans were still not playing with a full deck when it comes to facts, especially when those facts are rather a little made up, and cannot be applied any further than the object seen hanging within a mirror frame. This was a lesson Pappy was about to learn. His not-a-fruit economic theory of perpetual accretion, which existed because it suited him to believe it so, was about to take a fall. Pappy lost all his money in the inevitable global economic collapse, and as a result managed to live happily never before, with a dedicated, loving son, wife, and father, who, for his part, seemed determined to win a tacit longevity race against anybody game to take him on. In his room, Sean stuck up pictures of Einstein, Newton, and Galileo, and later added Napoleon and Laplace. He saluted Napoleon's frowning image every day before going to school, and any new school books were soon inaugurated with cartoons of Archimedes and Leonardo on their covers, and no number of penalties, threats, and orders to remove General could erase his love for those essential geniuses. And it was his watch which, more than anything else, reassured him by its gradually losing its pristine condition that he was now, after more than 4,000 years, finally in a world able to move past 15-11-2010, the year 2010 and 7/8. And when, some weeks later, Sean scratched the watch playing football, no one was more strangely pleased than he was to see that the Holy Grail was newly subject to spatial-temporal readjustments of its atomic order. In history, he failed every test from that day on, at least until he weaned himself off starting essays with, "When I met Napoleon, he was not wearing, as the textbook says, and his accent was quite funny, but I liked his horse, although his self-control left something to be desired." He was informed repeatedly by his teachers that these, although they may have been true, were not the sort of facts that make history worth reading. "Nuts to you," thought Sean. "These people are my friends, not yours." As for the haunted house, it became normal. Weathered, was lived in, renovated, lost its charm, and became just another house plunked down somewhere in Lugano's cluttered historical landscape. Sean went to Tramonta on Monte San Giorgio and found the place where the Time Egg Cavern may have opened up, but was solid earth now, and there he laid flowers to Amour and Elf, two would-have-been victims of accidents that never were, and he dreamed of the day he rode the sky above these treetops, courtesy of Leonardo da Vinci's flying machine, patent pending. He was pleased to learn that the bulldozer driver had woken from his coma and had achieved the prestigious rank of unmarketable writer, a large and growing club of people with special insight. "Good on you, Stinto," said Sean. And Shrody? She lived and lived till she decided that that was enough in a consistent, feline, fussy way, and became one of the very few creatures to cross the river to the world of non-awareness more than once, giving salary to the Greek myths that perhaps had got it right all along. But before that, the way Shrody looked at Sean with those secret, knowing cat's eyes left Sean in no doubt she knew what was what, and more importantly, what might have been, and therefore probably is still, some other when. Now you may be wondering what had happened to cause Sean's previous world to return to normal so simply. Was there ever a Vitruvian boy? Are we safe from a time cataclysm? Has the author been telling us fibs? Has his book been a waste of perfectly good imagination? The answer to all of these questions is a firmly enigmatic yes and no. The time paradox failsafe on a good day is still a hairy beast. It doesn't like inquisitive young children snooping about under its cloak of mystique. You see, Sean had understood, as everybody had been telling him, that his fall down the shaft with the time egg in his pocket had occurred, and therefore will occur again. As Pao told him, "And there is nothing you can do about it, so you had better do something about it." Thank you for that, Pao. Now, Professor Einstein had told Sean some curious things about reality, which physicists today still insist on labeling weird, the usual flavor being plain, which of course they are. But if Mr. Wonstone liked presenting weird things in his show, when he returned to being mild-mannered Swiss patents clerk, he didn't. He never took his work home with him. Clowns are serious artists, after all. This means that although he showed the world that reality is not at all as we think of it in a classical sense, he didn't like the idea that reality could thumb its nose at us whenever it wanted. Some of his best friends loved to tease him, and say that although reality near Einstein was playing along with him, chunks of reality a long way away, maybe even on the other side of the tent, were able to change the tune before they'd even heard the opening note. Einstein thought this was just plain spooky, and an infringement of his artistic license to create with his own free will. The rest of reality should jolly well listen first before joining in. Sean had to contend with the fact that there had definitely been a time quake, since his existence in the future world demanded it. So, inevitably, he realized that at least one of the two worlds had to have an expiring use-by date. Ah, but which world? Einstein's fundamental tickets-paid-up-front reality show? Or Nonno's plain, weird one where time apparently did not exist? Before you get your brains too diced up and thrown in the mixer, remember that it was Shrody who informed Sean of how to look at this strange situation. She had no trouble whatsoever living, or not, as the case may be, with two worlds. By being a consciousness, she in effect created two worlds continuously around her, and the whole of existence had to flip from one to the other, depending on which one she chose to be in. When she came to life in his arms, just before Sean entered the shaft, Sean knew that, since they were riding what Einstein may have called entangled time packets, on the other side of the VC moment, she must have just died. And he remembered that just as he entered the corridor where the trapdoor had been triggered open, Shrody had died, causing him to trip over her. She was the only element besides himself and the watch that existed in both worlds simultaneously, so helped him time the moment to enter the shaft and complete the Vitruvian crystal. Now you're going to ask why he wanted to complete the crystal. I thought so. This is the way to view time. Don't think about it for too long, or it starts to assert that it exists. Try to glance at it for an infinitely short moment, and don't blink. With a bit of practice, you will notice some interesting things. For example, all the atoms of the world, when they think you are not watching, manage to dissolve into a kind of blob of nothing, and then reform into the atoms you thought you knew and loved, in time for when you open your eyes again. In other words, atoms are wobbly at best. And that is what Vitruvian Boy did to save the world. He stepped inside one of those wobbles. You may also have been wondering what it is Sean asked the centurion to do on the time volcano. Sean, as you know, gave him a time void egg, which, as you no doubt guessed, the centurion took to the past world and rolled in front of Sean returning home from school. Then he brought back a real time egg, which Sean carried with him into the shaft beneath the house. Schoolboy Sean carried a time void egg down the shaft and met the incoming Vitruvian boy with a real time egg, and the eggs combined at precisely the VC moment to produce an eggnaut. Nobody but Sean and Schrody had experienced the two worlds. It was not that the others could not remember the event. For them, it had never been. Despite this, Nonno seemed to have the uncanny knack of being able to piece it together, primarily because he never dismissed what Sean said out of hand. Sean would sit long evenings with him on the balcony to his doing science room, looking at the ex-haunted house. "What happened in the Vitruvian crystal," Nonno said one day, "is the opposite of dropping a stone in water. Time was not rippling out, but rippling into the VC. Archimedes told us how to see the infinite, and Newton taught us how to use it, make a tool of the unknowable, break through man's artificial ceiling of superstition, and truly begin to speak to the gods. Truth is Archie's pie, the Archimedean pie, the golden ratio that unfolds the universe, never finished being calculated, never truly attained. But we can aspire towards it, and in so doing learn precisely our own limits. So even though we will never find the absolute truth, we know how not to stray to the wrong side of the uncertainty limits. And although it handles like a fish in a tank of oil, the important thing is that we can see clearly there is only one truth." Nonno's face became suddenly grave. "However, if you try to measure the circle directly, you can never know which side of the truth you are on. From there grow two infinitely misleading regions. It is there that Chespulio is free to reign. Two sides where people feel justified to believe whatever they find convenient, so are forever divided. And Chespulio buys their souls by simply telling them they are right. There is where his power, all that is potentially evil, lies." "Nonno," asked Sean, "how can we be sure we are safe, that Chespulio will never return?" "By retaining the ability to choose. That means not allowing our inventiveness to run our world for us. And we can measure that by how well we learn to reverse the destruction of the biosphere. Chespulio is, after all, a product of a possible future, a future in which we wreck this planet and make it uninhabitable. To disempower Chespulio, we must safeguard the natural world that defines us and permits us to stay human. We must, at all costs, protect nature if we hope to protect ourselves." "Nonno, do you think we'll ever know enough to time travel? Perhaps we should stop asking whether knowledge will ever be sufficient for us to time travel, because I think we are learning that there is no place to go in time. We are already there in the only moment there is. That is because there is a brand new timeline. You, Vitruvian boy, gave us the chance to decide our own future. It is not written. And this new timeline, is it stable?" "We have found a way to listen in to the throb of the heart of the universe, and I, for one, don't like what I hear. In another universe, not far away, inside the haunted house, perhaps, the music of the spheres is playing its own merry little tune, quite different to the beat and the rhythm we think we respond to out here, adrift as we are on a sea of uncertainty. So we could fall back over. How will we ever know which universe we are in?" "You will know. The 11 days of the Eternal War loop came from somewhere. And in one of the histories, those 11 days are missing. If you want to know which universe you are in, look for the missing 11 days. You have been listening to Vitruvian Boy, a novel by Andrew Bone,